The number one problem is when one person doesn't want to tell the other person about their assets or their goals. That's the number one issue.
Hi, my name is Mina Kim, your host of The Click Line. I've worked on Wall Street for over 14 years. Then I built out Orange Theory Fitnesses and sold them to a private equity firm. And upon that exit, started investing in women and minority startups, as well as advising women who are getting divorced with financial consulting and strategy. Welcome to The Click Line. Today we have Kelly Schindel DeLacy. She is a partner at DeLacy, Riebel & Schindel in San Francisco and focuses on complex family matters as such as property characterization, business valuation, spousal and child support, and highly contentious child custody disputes. Kelly is a certified family law specialist and has an extensive experience assisting clients through all phases of litigation, as well as creatively advising her clients in mediation and settlement negotiations. She's also named as a super lawyer in Northern California for over 10 years, as well as the top 50 women lawyers in Northern California for the last 8 years. So she is a badass in NorCal for everyone. Welcome to The Click Line, Kelly.
Thank you so much for having me, Mina.
Yes, thank you. And just for the audience to know, super lawyer is not me saying something cute like she's a super lawyer. It's actually a very rigorous process. There's 12 different indicators to being elected, verdicts, settlements, awards, licenses, and it's peer voting to become a super lawyer. So it's really the cream of the crop. It's the top 5% of the state. So my previous guest was also a super lawyer. Kelly is a super lawyer. It's the best of the best. So I just want everyone in the audience to know that's who they're getting today.
You are so kind. Thank you.
So Kelly, if you could tell us about the areas of matrimonial law that you practice in.
Sure. I specialize in typically high net worth family law actions, which in my area includes dissolution. It can include parentage as well. So for folks who are not married but have children together, as well as premarital agreements or even cohabitation agreements for folks who decide they don't want to get married but they are living together or they have children together. And I will do some agreements for those folks to contract their relationship. I don't do adoption or other guardianship, just to be clear.
So that's super interesting because I haven't really heard about cohabitation agreements. So I'd love to talk about that some more. And is this just California specific that has this cohabitation agreement, or is this kind of nationwide?
I think it's becoming more and more popular across the nation and potentially globally. I know I've worked with some other peers of mine in other countries in doing some of these agreements. They're very similar to a premarital agreement. So what we're doing is we're working with a couple and talking to them about what their goals and interests are for their relationship and how they see that partnership moving forward. And that includes their individual and couples' goals, of course. And then we can help protect them depending on what those goals are. So for example, in California, we do not have common law marriage. Other states do. But we do have a contractual claim that can be can come about later on. And that's called a Marvin action. It is after Lee Marvin. And we can talk about that later. But these were folks that back in the day had issues because they were not married. And they ended up bringing the issue to the California courts and discussing what their promises that they made to each other were and how and whether or not they should be held to those obligations. And so what we try to do is usually limit those types of claims so that people can enter into their relationship understanding exactly what they're getting into, and that frankly most of the time that they don't have those types of support obligations, or if they do, they're very crafted to what their relationship circumstances are. So if one person quit the job, for example, then the other person might decide, okay, well, I will contribute a certain amount of money, or maybe I will put a home in both of our names. Just kind of like what you would do with a premarital agreement, but for folks who aren't getting married.
Mm-hmm. And so is there a time length that qualifies you for under the Marvin claim? So like, what if you started dating someone and moved in 2 months later compared to someone who's been dating for 5 years? Is there a difference?
It's not strict. So that's the key that you need to remember. Really, it has to do with what your circumstances are. So people can get together and, you know, not move in together for 10 years. That's very different than the circumstance where a couple gets together, maybe 6 months into it, they are dating, one person decides to move across the country for the other person and quit their job, let's say. And as part of that, let's just say the person who is living in California promises them, well, hey, if you quit your job and you come live with me, then I'll take care of you for that, you know, until you get another job. Well, that then opens up the door for claims. And what we're trying to do, because it's very discretionary, all of these things, we're trying to really set people up for success in those conversations and expectations so that they know what that means. All right, well, if we live together for a year, and, you know, we're meeting these certain requirements that we've set, then I will be responsible for, in this circumstance, support for a certain amount of time. Or you can remain in my home and you don't have to pay for rent. Or sometimes it has to, I mean, people start to have children in relationships that where they're not getting married as well, and making decisions around that, that can pretty clearly shift their obligations to each other. So that could also be a factor that the court would consider if you were to fight about it later. And we're trying to just avoid those fights. So really, it's just opening the conversation early.
Right, which I think is smart. And if there was a breakup, is there a clause in there for them to actually leave your house as well, or apartment? Because I've heard of horror stories where people don't leave.
Yes, we do that pretty regularly. We also will reach out to financial advisors. We reach out to estate planners. We reach out to real estate lawyers to, depending on what the, you know, what they're wanting to do, to make sure that we're meeting the requirements of our state. And this would be in anybody's jurisdiction. You'd need to reach out to those experts to see what they can do. And then also see what might be good for the circumstances. So for example, if we have a financial advisor that's involved, we will sometimes use them jointly. Like, okay, look, this is our budget. What should this look like? How much should I contribute? How much should I pay on behalf of the other side, for example? And that can be really helpful. We, for like a real estate lawyer, we can talk about the local jurisdiction as it relates to, as you said, like eviction, because there's certain things that you want to be able to control when you're leaving a relationship. And if the area that you're living in has really strict eviction rules, you need to know that. And every area is going to be wildly different. San Francisco has very strict eviction and renters' rights, so tenants' rights. So we are having to be very careful about the language that we use in that regard. As an example.
Got it. Okay. And then, so for prenups, when people are coming to you, what are some of the common issues that you wish people would have addressed before coming to this stage with you?
That's a good question. I actually was just talking to one of my friends who works a lot with startups as a corporate lawyer, and she said, I wish people took a class before we got married. because in the Bay Area, we have a lot of startups. So, you know, it's oftentimes it's young people with great big ideas, and they're starting this amazing new thing that could be the next Google or Facebook or whatever. And you never know. And oftentimes they're not necessarily thinking about that. So my job when I meet with people for either cohabitation agreements or prenups is to really talk to them about their goals. And then I think I mentioned earlier their individual goals and as well as like their goals as a couple. And typically I ask people to give me their top five just to kind of see and open the conversation about what their interests are. Some people feel really strongly about sharing a house, for example. The house comes up a lot. Like, if we live in the same home, I want it to be our home. I don't want to be living in your home. That is a common theme that we see. But frankly, what I do, I sit down, I ask about those goals, and then I educate a person on what California law is, and I go through and tell them what it looks like if they were to do nothing. So if they were to have no agreements whatsoever. And then I layer on those goals that they gave me, and I say, well, okay, with that goal, right now you might see a couple of areas where this could cause some problems on, you know, let's just say the housing issue. We'll start there because I gave that as an example. With ownership of homes, if you own a home before you get married, that's your separate property. So if you want that home to be a community property asset, then we have to take certain steps to make sure that that's clear in your prenuptial agreement, that that occurs in a different way than California law would provide. So we just go through all of that based on what their goals are as a family, and then also what their goals are as individuals. And sometimes we do cohabitation agreements that are also prenuptial agreements, where we do both because we know that they're planning on getting married. So maybe they're living together and they don't get married for another year and a half, but they want to make sure that they're protected for that period leading up to the marriage so that there isn't those Marvin claims, or if you're in other areas, kind of a common law marriage claim. So we are very, very clear about what the expectations are of both parties and their kind of coupleship, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And during these prenup discussions, do you see a common area where there's a disagreement or a misunderstanding?
That's, yes. The number one problem is when one person doesn't want to tell the other person about their assets or their goals. That's the number one issue. And in California, you really can't do that. So it's always a red flag for me about their marriage. Like, okay, if you're not wanting to even have the conversation about what you have and what you want to do with it, there's going to be tough roads ahead. But you haven't actually part of our, there's pretty strict rules around disclosures when you enter into a prenuptial agreement, because people need to have full understanding, right, of what they're in, what kind of contract they're entering into. So we're really careful around making sure that you disclose all assets, liabilities, interests to the other person beforehand. And it covers, and I do that actually for cohabitation agreements, and it's, the rules are not quite as clear quite yet. I think they're probably going to evolve in that manner, but I do the same thing for cohab agreements too.
Right. And so I've said this to friends and clients as well, is that, you know, if it's that difficult in the beginning stage where you're not getting the right information and it's this hard to get, you know, an inch of information, imagine on the way out how difficult it's going to be, right? So you have to think both ways and really, you know, review if you and think about, like, is this something that I really want to do and go forward with? Because it's a much harder thing to unravel when you're as you know, on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, it is. And also, like, you just want, I like to pitch it so that it's more of a exciting time, right? Like, this is a time for you, the person that you're planning on spending the rest of your life with. You get an opportunity to talk about those exciting goals, those things, those visions that you have about your relationship. I really, you know, and the way you have that conversation can also be different. So some people will do a prenup with a mediator, so they have a third party that's kind of facilitating the conversation. Other folks, we will sit down in a room all together. So it'll be a lawyer for one party and then a lawyer for the other party, all four of us sitting together and really working through what the terms are and the goals are. So it doesn't have to just be like, you know, I draft it up and I hand it over and I say, these are the terms that she wants. Take it or leave it. It's not like that. We've got options.
Great. Yeah. And so what happens since you're in Silicon Valley, I'm sure you see this a lot and you briefly mentioned, but you're starting a business, a startup, you don't know if it's going to be successful or not. But once you're married, then all of a sudden it explodes in growth exponentially while you're together. How does the courts view that as far as community property?
So your time, skill, and effort is your separate, is your community property during the marriage. So if that makes sense, like the hours that you spend on something is those hours, that energy is a community asset, unless you are going to contract it differently under California law. So that means that even if you had a business prior to your marriage, and it's, say it's Kelly Inc., and Kelly Inc. was started prior to my marriage, but I get married a year later, and then I spend 7 years working at Kelly Inc. every day, and I don't have a prenup, and community property laws apply. Technically, is the business separate property? And the character, yes, it's characterized as separate property. But then there can be valuation and apportionment methodologies based on the fact that I utilized my energy. And of course, it depends on the business, depends on how I pay myself. All of the other things complicate the analysis, which we won't have time to get into today unless we had hours. But that does have value.
Right. Okay. And so, I mean, just thinking about valuation, if someone has a business or their spouse does, and we're thinking about how do we value this? I know you bring in experts, but are there multiple third-party experts that come in and value a business? How does that actually work?
Yes. So I always, typically because of the types of business and entities that I deal with, they're very complicated. So I always have a forensic expert available. Usually we have an accountant that is also doing, you know, tracing of the person's separate property, or if they have assets that we've identified in a prenuptial agreement that are their separate property, we still have to prove that up. And the other aspect of this has to do with valuation. So you usually have an expert that is a specialist in business valuations. Take a look at the type of company that you have, and then they will basically ask for all of the right associated documentation that will help them work with me on whether or not we need to do a valuation. If those valuation, like if the valuation is going to be really worth it, if it's going to be more expensive than what it's worth, and if we need to do some more informal meeting and conferring with the other side, or if it's really going to take a big deep dive, how they can communicate with the other side's expert, because typically both sides have experts in these areas so that they can work together, come to the agreements where they can, and then we end up narrowing those issues, and that's where we end up going to court and having litigation if we are unable to come to an agreement. Most cases, we're able to resolve it, and those experts assist counsel and the parties in coming to a reasonable settlement of some sort.
Right. So it's fair to have your own expert on your side, and the other side may have their own forensic expert for business valuations to take a look.
Almost every time. Yeah, in California. I know that there's some areas where they don't do that, but you can do a joint expert. But if you think about that, like as soon as you get a joint expert, most people also get their own separate experts on top of that to review it. So you've got three instead of just two. So we will typically target out two.
Right. And it may seem like a lot of work and a big step, but I think it's important because I've worked with clients as well as I work with high net worth individuals as they're going through the divorce process for financial strategy consulting. And I've sent a few clients your way as well. And
Thank you. By the way,
they all love you.
Thank you.
And I know it's been really difficult when looking at trying to value businesses because some have been private for 30 years and may never sell, or, you know, it's a complex business where there's multiple people involved or factors. Maybe a private equity firm has a share, things like that. So I think it's important for people who are starting out and are thinking about this process to understand, even if it costs X amount to bring in an expert, it's well worth it. And you need to have someone on your side to take a look.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the word that comes to mind is front loading. And that can be scary to parties that are going through this because it seems like it's a lot. But frankly, it's way more expensive if you wait. So oftentimes those same forensic experts will help us do certain disclosures as part of the divorce process. They will help us do it from the beginning so that we're consistent in our positioning too, because the worst case scenario is you get in your divorce, you start the process, you provide information willy-nilly, and then all of a sudden you realize maybe some of the positions that you took are inconsistent with now your bigger picture strategy you have on your business valuation, or one aspect of it now negatively impacts it. You don't want to be in that position. So having those experts and that information front-loaded, and that means just kind of a little bit more advanced, is actually the wiser way to go instead of waiting until later. There's an example of this. I had a trial and it was on a prenuptial agreement. My client and I did the analysis as to whether or not it was kind of worth fighting about it. And we decided, you know what, it wasn't worth fighting about. The other side did not do that analysis and they insisted on moving forward. And I'm like, look, if you win, this is not the outcome isn't good for you. And they hadn't done that second step. They just wanted to fight about the validity of the prenuptial agreement, because there's feelings. This human component of what we do just makes people crazy, frankly. They're not their best self. So they didn't look ahead. They didn't front load that information or that work. And because they didn't do that, they ended up spending a ton of time and money on something that didn't matter.
Has a prenup ever been pierced?
Yes. Yeah. So we talk about that as validity. And it's one of the reasons why drafting prenups is also so important to me, because I have invalidated prenuptial agreements after the fact. And you don't want that, right? So you have to make sure there's certain requirements in every state that will, depending on the state, be more specific than others, of course. But in California, we have very specific requirements that were clarified after Barry Bonds. I don't know if you've heard of Barry Bonds.
The baseball player? Yeah.
Yeah, right. So he had a big case and it had to do with prenups. And they actually clarified a lot of the rules that were already in place, but not quite that clear. That case helped us as practitioners understand what we have to do more directly. It includes having a certain number of days prior before signing the final agreement, how it has to be a number of days prior to getting married, counsel, disclosures, all of those things that we started to talk about before when we were talking about prenups. There's pretty strict requirements about what we have to make sure that people are signing it voluntarily, not under duress. You know, you can't be pregnant signing it the day before you get married with your entire family coming. That's not going to be a good look. And those are the times when you can invalidate those agreements versus having an enforceable contract that you're going to be bringing forward. There's also other areas where you can have interpretation challenges or challenges to just single parts of the contract. So you'd have to sever that out. So for example, it's against public policy to include child-related terms in there around custody or visitation or support, because it goes against our public policy in California for a number of reasons. But, you know, one being state's interest. They don't want to be responsible for children, and you can't just kind of like willy-nilly waive your obligations to your child. Those particular types of terms, they're against public policy. The court will find that they're not going to be enforceable, and they will essentially kind of like remove those terms from a prenuptial agreement, even if it's valid and enforceable in other aspects and ways.
And so how many days do you need to review a prenup before signing?
7 in California.
7 days.
From the final draft. So I actually am extra anal about it. And it doesn't matter. People will come to me. I have a 6-month requirement. I will not do a prenup unless your marriage is going to be at least 6 months from the date that you come to me, because it takes a long time. Even if you're a really fast worker and you say you're going to do this really quickly and everybody agrees to everything, it's never the case, ever, never, ever. So we have enough time to be able to go through it, negotiate. It's really important to have those terms actually change a little bit when you're talking, and do all of your disclosures, have enough time to review it, and then I like to have a month. So I like them to be able to sign the final draft at least a month before their marriage.
Right.
It limits the ability to have somebody then invalidate it because of time and because you didn't have enough time to review it, or you had pressure before family came into town, or, you know, contracts ended. The earlier, the better.
Right. Yeah. And so when you're working on prenups, do you find that a lot of people end up going through with it, or is there like a 10% fallout rate or something once they start the process?
That's interesting. I've had a couple of clients who, as part of the process, their relationship falls apart. And I guess I can say it's sad, but it's also good that they learned before they got married and had a much, much harder, you know, ending than beginning. So I will say that also the more recent ones, they were folks that had also been through a divorce years before. And so I had done both their divorce and then their prenup. And the level of caution that people have after they've had a tough divorce and the anxiety and the stress, I mean, that's just a human experience, right? So they come in wanting to make sure that every possible scenario is thought of. And I'm like, you know what? We're guessing and gambling here because I don't know what issues are going to come up for you. We can try. But oftentimes I think that creates a level of stress in a relationship. So, you know, that I would say is the consistent component there is like people who are, maybe putting a little too much pressure on the relationship. But I have seen many not work out.
Right. And now the statistics on the second marriage divorcing is closer to 70%, I think I saw. And for the first marriage is like 54-55%. It's inching around there. So it's really important for everyone to feel comfortable and feel like it's the right move for them for either situation, the first or the second now, and to be prepared.
I mean, it's also why I don't know the exact percentage, of course, but I think even the number of marriages and the percentages of people who do get married and when they get married has changed over time because people are aware of that. And I think that's one of the reasons why COMAB agreements are also showing up a little bit more.
Yeah, I was going to say,
I don't know that I want to get married. I need to know if I can do this with you before I make that step.
Yeah, I think cohabitation is very smart. If you're in California and thinking about moving in, that's the way to go. And so we're talking about divorce and spousal support. Is there a general calculation for support? How is that viewed?
Spousal support is probably one of the areas that drives me the most crazy it's not really quantifiable for our long-term support calculation. So in California, there is a presumption that if you've been married for 10 years or longer, that's a long-term marriage. And for anything under 10 years, the presumption under our code, Family Code 4320, is that you're going to have support for half of the length of the marriage. So if you've been married for 8 years, you're going to have potentially the supported spouse would be getting support for 4 years. If it's over 10 years, however, the court can't really, there's no strict number or amount and even termination really. And they have to apply these factors that are 14 or 15 different factors that provide zero calculations at all. So it's like considering a lot of things that are very important, but it does not say something quantifiable. So we can never tell to our clients, look, this is exactly what you're going to have to pay. You've been married for 23 years. This is what it looks like. It is all very much on a case-by-case basis. It greatly depends upon what you're going to get as part of the division of your assets, as part of your divorce, and then what income you have off of those assets. And if you're employed, of course. But then there's other factors, like did you stop working so that the other person could further their career? So in our example, that one person moves across the country, quits their job, and supports this other person's business. Well, that's awesome, except for now the person who moved doesn't have their 401k. So they're not only not getting the earnings right then, but they're also not putting in assets for purposes of their retirement in the future. or maybe they're a scientist and they no longer are up to speed on the most recent scientific method of what they're, you know, they're supposed to do in their job. So now they're completely behind. All of those things are taken into consideration, along with domestic violence, their age, their health, whether or not there's other type of, like, I don't know, general things the court has to consider. Who knows what that is? It's going to be different for every family.
Like how many kids they're taking care of?
Sure. If there's special needs, right? Like what if you have a child that is in a wheelchair and is going to need, you know, every 24-hour care, and you need a parent who's able to facilitate that and be there to do that? That's going to look very different than a person who's in, you know, in also working at Google, but just not making quite as much. That's going to look completely different. And then you've got folks who maybe were both married for 9 years, but they had similar jobs and both are continuing to work, no kids. There might not be any support at all in those cases. So it's really going to depend on every single case, how the facts around what they've got. And that can be hard to tell a client, right? Because my clients want to know answers. One of the things a prenup can do is it can actually try to structure that. It is also one of the areas where a court can unravel it. If at the time, in California, it's different than other states too. At the time of your divorce, if the spousal support arrangement, whether it's a waiver or something else in your prenup, isn't found to be conscionable, meaning it's unconscionable at the time, then the court can invalidate that section and they will apply California Family Code 4320. Typically that looks like, I mean, this is where we're really careful in prenups too. Like you have to, that's why just a straight waiver usually isn't a great idea. We usually have some other pieces where assets are transferred over time or a certain payout is made, because then it's more likely to be enforced later. But really what the court's worried about is if a person is in an unexpected situation, like let's just say I get married and I'm kind of an equal to my partner and our prenup says I waived it because we were equal, but then I get breast cancer 3 times and I haven't worked in 15 years. The court doesn't want to leave me without any support. And that makes complete sense. I think most people, you know, can understand that. But it is definitely one of the areas where we have the most litigation in my practice, where we'll settle almost everything else and then we'll have a trial over permanent spousal support.
Got it. Interesting. And so what happens if, you know, we get married in California, but then we move to Florida, right? So then, and then we get divorced in Florida. What happens? What law gets applied?
Florida law applies if you are properly under their jurisdiction, meaning, you know, in California, to be under our jurisdiction, you have to be here for 6 months in the state and 3 months in the county. I don't know what Florida law requires, but whatever their requirement is, let's just say it's something
much higher, I think.
Yeah, whatever theirs is. Yeah. Then if you qualify for that, then you're going to be applying Florida law unless you have a prenup. Now, if you have a prenup that says California law governs, then Florida will have to look to the prenup, figure out which aspects of that prenuptial agreement, if there's any, that violate their public policy or that they have to challenge, but then the rest of it is California law. So I've had several cases with New York, but also internationally. We've got a lot. This is a global world we're living in, right? Where people get married and then move across the world. We have prenuptial agreements that will provide for New York law to apply, and then I have to apply that, including in valuations of businesses or how we deal with unconscionability. I mean, we've had this argument about kind of the governing rule over and over again. And the prenups tend to help resolve that, usually. Obviously, there's some areas where that can be challenged. But always, if you know that you might be getting a situation where your client might move, you talk to them, especially if you're doing a prenup, you talk to them about those jurisdictions and you reach out to a person. Like for me, if I know someone's going to move to Singapore, I will reach out to some of my colleagues in the International Academy that I'm fellows with, and I reach out and I say, hey, could you take a look at my agreement and see if there's areas where those would be in direct conflict with your laws so that we can try to build in language on how those can be protected if they move, because there's a, you know, a chance that they're going to move to Singapore in this hypothetical.
Got it. Okay. Interesting. And so is spousal support and settlement taxed?
Good question. In California, spousal support is not taxed federally. I mean, is taxed, but in the federal taxation reform that occurred, I think it was like 2018 with Trump's first reform, it's no longer taxable. So it used to be that it was taxable and deductible in state court and in federal court. Now it's just state court, and child support is not either. So in California, you just have a little bit of tax on spousal support.
And so for child support, is there a general calculation for that too, or is that all, how does that work?
Yes. In California, we have a guideline calculator and formula. The formula is extraordinarily complicated. It's in our statute. They don't trust lawyers to do math. So they have a couple of different calculators. Right now, we just shifted from DisoMaster to the ex-spouse, and there's a couple of other ones that are out there. You can also have your forensic accountant run the calculations for you, but that formula is essentially a tax formula. You use gross numbers from each party's income, both from earnings or other assets. You look to, a big part of it is the percentage of time that they spend with the child or children, and it calculates that, and it's called, it's our guideline-based support number. Unlike other states, there's not an automatic cap on how much you can pay in child support. You can make a request for a high earner cap, which you have to bring kind of formally to the court, but other states will have a max amount of child support that you can pay or you have to pay. That's not the case in California. It is based on that guideline, based on the assets that you've got. So if you're a billionaire, you're making a lot of child support payments. Now, what I was referring to as far as a cap is something where the court can consider the needs of children. So if an amount of support is just going to wildly exceed the needs of kids, then obviously they don't need to be paying at that level. They just need to be paying such that the children are at a similar standard in both homes. What they don't want is somebody living in, you know, the $50 million residence with the other person living in a rental apartment.
Right.
If their parents are at, you know, very different stations in life.
Do they take into account the debt as well? I know you mentioned gross income, but for instance, the $50 million house could have a $40 million loan on it. We don't know, right?
Sure. Yes. I mean, income available for support is just that. I mean, it's not just on the face of it, but your residence isn't really your income. It's really your, that's why that, remember I was talking about
asset.
Yeah, the assets. I mean, it's crazy because that 4320 code section, when you're looking at spousal support, they talk about marital standard of living. Again, they don't put a calculation for that, but it's kind of a similar concept of like a station in life, where if a person goes from flying private jets all the time and to having multiple homes across the world, the globe, to not, then, you know, that station in life has changed pretty dramatically. And what the court is trying to do is find a somewhat level of parity between the two. Obviously, it's not going to be exactly the same because you have to split the same bucket into two. But it is similar with the kids. Like they want the kids to be able to have somewhat of a similar lifestyle.
Quality of life, right?
We have had the fight about, like, is it good for kids to have too much? And we've had experts come in and talk about how it's actually not great for their psychology to be having support at this level because they're getting like this lifestyle that's going to make them not great humans. And then you've got this fight over values. I mean, that's like, again, this is why I'm saying there's no real answer to this. The judges hear the arguments and they have to make decisions based on the facts that are in front of them. So,
well, every day seems very exciting.
I try to encourage my clients to be the architects of their own future. And meaning like settling it. And even if it feels bad, it's not exactly what they want. It's better than having a random stranger making a decision about your life.
200%.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes that person's really paying attention, but sometimes they're not. And then what? It's like going into the DMV. Ugh. You know, like maybe you get a person that helps you. Maybe you're waiting there for a long time to get nothing.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And working in finance for over 14 years, too, I remember one of my bosses said, you know, the best deal is the deal with both sides are a little unhappy.
Yes, 100%.
But you come out feeling you got something fair. So that's kind of how I viewed things, everything, actually, from that, what he said to me that one time. And I think that's right in all aspects.
It's very wise. It's very wise. People also, I think, you know, when I talk to my clients after the fact, you're in a very different place, right? So in the moment when you're in that soul reptilian part of your brain going through a divorce, you know, some people are totally fine. They're like cool cucumbers, right? They're like, you know what? I'll make more money. This is the father of my children. It's totally fine. Other people, yeah. Whoo,
rage.
It's like they're, yeah. And it's as if they're at, like, they're in some sort of war and they're protecting their own, you know, life and their children's lives. And I'm like, yeah, yes. And it's hard, you know, you can't tell someone that their feelings aren't what they are. So I have to kind of go through that journey with them. I feel very privileged that I get to go through the journey and help people, but it can be very difficult.
And which is also why it's really important for people to have a really good support team, meaning also a therapist on board, you know, that you're talking to, the kids are, your spouse hopefully is, and as well as attorney, accountants, divorce coach, whoever that is, besides your friends and family, because you do need to have, you know, this type of support that is going to be with you throughout the process and after. So it's really important to start assembling that team.
It is. I mean, that front loading that I was talking about, it doesn't mean just with the financial people who are helping protect, you know, your squirrel away your nuts. That's not the only piece. There's also this other piece, which is like parent coaches or a co-parent counselor or an individual therapist, especially if my clients are having and struggling with some tougher situations, which, you know, it is unfortunate, but we see a lot. I want them to be their best self in this process. And if they're not able to compartmentalize a little bit, it can be a distraction. It can be expensive. It can really take a toll on their children, right? I mean, it has the domino effect there can be pretty impactful. So we want to get the support.
And so what has been kind of like a very, I know you work on a lot of contentious child custody disputes. What has been kind of an example of that and how it got resolved?
Yeah, there's been, gosh, I know we talked about this a little bit before. Right now, the bane of my existence is resist-refuse dynamic cases where kids are just pushing away one parent. They're the saddest for me, frankly. And I think you've got usually a lot of professionals involved and overseeing it. And a lot of the times it's not successful and it's just heartbreaking. There's one case where my client who is lovely. He, at the beginning of the case, the other side filed a request to move away. And that particular positioning, I should say, in litigation is very threatening because it's unknown. It's discretionary, right? You have to go through a full custody evaluation by a psychologist. You've got to have interviewed teachers and child care providers, the children themselves, and the parents. And then this person writes up a very large, very detailed, sometimes there's even psych testing involved. So like it can be tough to read as a parent. And they come up with this response that's like, yes, we recommend you can move, or no, we don't recommend you can move. And in California, there are certain things they have to look to and laws that they have to evaluate when considering what's best for the kids and in a move. Well, in this particular case, we were in the middle of a mediation. This move away was filed, and it was very clearly a litigation tactic to try to put pressure on my guy, who happened to be the kind of the higher earner, if you will, in the case. The mom had not worked for much of the marriage. And my client had a lot of money from separate property businesses that he had started and done very well with. And in the end, after many, many, many months of fighting and arguing and threatening with the moves and other things, ultimately what he did and what we evaluated was like, what are the most important things to him, right? What are your goals? Again, going back to that first conversation about the things that are in your heart, like the things that are most important. And for him, it was being close to his kids. That was the number one thing. So when we evaluated that and we were looking at what the other side's goals and fears were, hers was financial insecurity. So how do we deal with financial insecurity as her goals and fears, and then him not having a relationship or being close to his kids? And what we did is we ended up coming to an arrangement where he purchased a home, and it was basically above and beyond what this person would get as part of the division of the estate because of his separate property and their prenup they had in place. He went above that, and he decided to put a home in a trust for the children until the kids were 18. And then at that time, the home transferred to the mom. The only way that was going to happen is if she did not move. So there was kind of a quid pro quo there, like, you know what, I will hook you up and take care of you and make sure you're not afraid of your own housing situation or your money, because that's where your fears and goals are. But you need to also make that commitment to me and make the commitment to our children that we're going to be close together. And they lived down the street from each other until the children were 18. And then he transferred the home over to the wife, or ex-wife, I should say. Yeah.
Yes. I actually really like that solution, and that it's creative and it's solving both sides' problems. So I think that's an amazing story of how important it is to have a good attorney with creative solutions on your side, because, you know, some people might be like, no, you can't move, you can't do this, and it blows up and it ruptures the whole communication line and the relationship. And then for the kids too, you know, how they're going to live and how they view relationships and their parents, and it's already a difficult situation. So I love how that solution was geared towards both sides, and it's a really fair ground in the middle. And so, and thanks. Both sides lose a little, right, yep. of what they want, yeah. but it's fair. At the end of the day, it was fair. So I think that's great. And so what was the most rewarding case that you've worked on?
I had a client who, when she was 2 weeks post-delivery, she had postpartum depression really bad. And she went to a bad place. Let's just put it that way. And the other side, instead of getting her help and working on their relationship, filed a restraining order and took the baby away from her and filed for a divorce. And so she did not, yeah, right. So she did not have any access, when I say zero access, to a brand new baby. And she came to see me maybe a couple months after that. So it had been 2 months maybe. She hadn't seen the baby. They allowed for some supervised visits. And I don't know, I would say it took us almost a year, but she ended up getting 50-50 custody. I will say that it was complicated by mental health issues. It was also complicated by a person who was emotionally abusive to a person who has mental health issues. So really, that getting all of the professionals involved and making sure that she was able to have a healthy relationship with her child and that she got the care that she needed and she was able to be present in the best possible way for her son, making that happen. And also, frankly, seeing that this person got called out on his bad, I mean, he used it to get her out of his life, and in a way that was it was not okay. So ultimately we had custody evaluators involved, private judges, and they ultimately found that he was not furthering the mother and child relationship, and they put a lot of that on him. And I ended up getting back to a 50-50 timeshare, which was a huge win for me.
That's great. That's really amazing. I love that. And so lastly, as you know, the name of my podcast is Click Line, When Everything Clicks. So what's a moment in your personal or professional life when something all of a sudden clicked for you?
I would say we, as lawyers, go in and we have all of this pressure on us, and we come out, we take the bar, you pass the bar, you get sworn in, you're supposed to be this like badass who's able to do their job, and really you know nothing, you're terrified of being sued, you're like all of your family, friends, and strangers are asking you questions immediately, and you're like, hold on. So I spent maybe 3 years feeling terrified. And then I was like a couple of years into it, I was like, okay, I actually feel like I know what I'm kind of doing. I don't know. And then I got slammed really hard, you know, losing a couple of cases, having people just completely school me. And then around like, I would say 7, 8, 9 years of practice, I had this like freedom happen for me. And it was really around... the knowledge that I don't know everything, I don't have to know everything, that the most important thing about my job is being curious and being like thought partners with my clients, with experts, and just having that skill set is the best part of what I do every day. And that's why they call it the practice of law. This is a practice. We're never going to ever be like have everything crammed into our little brains and know every case and every code section. And as soon as I could really, I don't know, absorb that and be curious about all the things I didn't know, I don't know, something just clicked and it made me really enjoy and love what I do even more.
Oh, I love that. And I feel like that is also something that can be applied to all areas of life, just being curious and open to all of the possibilities and knowing that you don't know.
And it's okay to say that, right? It's okay to say,
yeah,
you know what? I'm going to go talk to somebody about this because I've got these really amazing resources. And that's the beauty of what I do, is I get to learn new things. Every single case is different. And that's exciting, not terrifying. I don't need to pretend like I know it all. I can just go through this and really, I don't know. Then I get to kick butt because I get to learn new things and have even more people to help support my clients.
Yes, I think that's so important. And it's a great way to look at life and at your profession and everything we do, because if you look at it with an open, curious mind, then you're able to explore different levels of not only knowledge, but kind of like being able to reach different levels of wisdom in how you view things. And so I think I love that. And I love that being, how many years have you been practicing?
20. I've been practicing for 20.
And year 7, 8, 9, this is what clicked. So for everyone out there, you know, it's a process. Life is a process. Your work life, real life, everything is a process. And sometimes it, you know, takes a while for something to click, but be open to it and have a curious mind to it, I would say. So thank you so much, Kelly. I really appreciate you coming on. I'm grateful for you and your knowledge. I love what you're doing and how your approach to everything. So thank you for coming on the Click Line.
Thank you so much for having me.
Don't forget to send in your questions and comments to the Click Line. And one more thing, the views and opinions expressed on this podcast are for informational and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered professional advice. Please consult with qualified professionals for advice related to your specific situation.